From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Another day of primaries has come and gone, and this one made history. In Vermont, Christine Hallquist secured the Democratic nomination for governor. She's the first openly transgender person to win a major party nomination for that post. It sets up a potentially competitive gubernatorial race in that state. In Kansas, immigration hardliner Kris Kobach is the Republican nominee for governor, beating out the incumbent, who conceded yesterday. The margins were narrow, and the November fight may be narrow as well. We're joined by NPR political reporter Jessica Taylor. Jessica, let's start with a wider perspective here. What's the upshot of the primaries across the board yesterday?
Well, both parties got some of the nominees that they wanted, but we are seeing a really diverse group of Democratic candidates emerge. You mentioned Christine Hallquist. We also saw in Minnesota Ilhan Omar, who is the first Somali American legislator in the country, won her nomination. She's likely to be elected in a heavily Democratic district in Minnesota there, and she's poised to become one of the first Muslim women in Congress too, joining another woman who is likely to be elected after winning her primary last week in Michigan. We saw more Democratic women win their primaries. So there is a diverse group of candidates across the board that Democrats especially have.
Okay, so let's parse some of these races out. We've got to talk about Christine Hallquist, the Democratic nominee. Spoke to Morning Edition today. She had voted for the current Republican Governor Phil Scott in Vermont, but she said that the state needed a change.
I knew our current governor. He's a very nice guy. But, you know, November 9th of 2016 was entirely different than November 8th. And we really need a bold and courageous governor now who's going to actively work with other states to push back on some of these things coming out of Washington.
Can you tell us what she's talking about there in terms of the dates being different and whether or not you think she has a shot in November?
Yeah, I mean, she's trying to nationalize this race, certainly. Scott is someone that, even Vermont being a very blue state, had been pretty popular. And, you know, she admitted she even voted for him. But he has seen his popularity, his approval numbers drop there. He signed a sweeping gun control reform bill into law there. And that hurt him, especially with Republicans and independents. Vermont still is a pretty gun rights friendly state. But he still does have pretty good numbers with Democrats, especially. So she has to win over some members of her own party and say, you may like this guy, but we need to send a message nationally. And a lot of times that's harder to do on a gubernatorial level than it is maybe for Senate or for Congress.
Jessica, the Kansas primary race between Kris Kobach and the incumbent governor, Kris Collier, was finally decided, and Kobach won by a mere hundreds of votes. Democrats were actually hoping for him to win because they think they might have a better chance against him later on. Tell us about who the Democratic nominee for governor is and why they think that she has a better chance.
Well, Laura Kelly, she's been very active in some of the teacher upheaval there, pushing for unions and for higher pay and things, too. And so this is a state that has had a lot of political upheaval, too. The former he beat Collier there, who had assumed the governorship after Sam Brownback was appointed the U.S. ambassador for religious freedom. And Brownback had suffered a lot there because he had sort of plunged the state into a budget crisis and a lot of the questions about the state's financial future, and they're hoping that that will sort of hurt Kobach. And he also is far more conservative than Collier was, and even in many ways the Brownback, who is pretty conservative, was too. You know, he's been very outspoken on immigration reform and or against immigration reform, very stringent immigration hardliner, much in the line of Donald Trump. He's a close Trump ally. Trump tweeted his support for him before the primary and tweeted his congratulations this morning. But also he's been talking about these unsubstantiated claims of widespread voter fraud. He was the leader of President Trump's maligned commission to investigate widespread voter fraud in the 2016 elections, which amounted to nothing. And so he's someone that is a very polarizing figure. They're hoping that they can take this in even a red state, all of those things combined, make it competitive. There is potentially an independent that could get on the ballot that could complicate things. But even if they don't flip this seat, there are several competitive House seats there, too, that they hope that Democrats hope he could be a drag on. There are several seats there that they're eyeing to flip, even in Kansas.
Okay, just about 30 seconds left. Just give us the brief on Minnesota and Wisconsin.
So Keith Ellison, who is the Democratic National DNC vice chairman, he won his primary for attorney general, but he's battling allegations of abuse by a former ex-girlfriend.
This is Minnesota.
Yes, Minnesota. And he has denied those. The DNC put out a statement to NPR yesterday saying they are investigating those. In Wisconsin, you have Terry Evers, who is the state superintendent of education, won the nomination for governor for Democrats. They're angling to take out Scott Walker, the Wisconsin governor. He survived attempt after attempt, including a 2012 recall.
Got to end it there. Jessica Taylor, sorry, NPR's political reporter. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Well, to Italy, where crews pulled more bodies out of tons of broken concrete and twisted steel today after that highway bridge collapse in Genoa yesterday. The collapse of the Morandi Bridge, which connects Italy and France, sent dozens of cars and trucks plunging as far as 150 feet as if they were Tinker Toys. Italian officials say 39 people died, and now the Italian government is blaming the company that manages the bridge. NPR's Silvia Pagioli is in Rome. Still, Sylvia, we still can't get used to these pictures. What a horrible scene.
Oh, it's absolutely devastating. Italian television, it's just like a constant 24-hour coverage of this thing. The scenes are really quite amazing. The rescue effort is continuing. The head of the Civil Protection Department said some 1,000 rescuers, police, firemen, and emergency workers are on the site searching for any possible missing persons. You know, the collapse happened around noon under torrential rain and on the eve of today's major summer holiday, which means that traffic was very intense. About 40 vehicles, cars and trucks were crossing the section of the bridge that collapsed and are now crushed under the rubble. Huge slabs of the bridge's reinforced concrete that plunged to the riverbed, railway line, and on top of some warehouses.
Yeah, it's just stunning. We're thinking of images from this country, I-95, a highway in Connecticut. I know you're familiar with it, you know, when part of that fell, and, you know, a bridge in Minneapolis. That image of the cars that just stopped in time, we're also seeing that, you know, a truck inches from going over itself. But talk more about the government blaming the company that manages the bridge.
The media is reporting that warnings about the structure's deterioration had been circulating for several years. You know, there's little doubt that the intensity of the traffic and the weight of the vehicles had far exceeded the bridge's capacity when it was built in 1967. A Genoa's chief prosecutor, Francesco Cozzi, said his investigation will focus on maintenance and design. But he stressed that had serious concerns about the bridge's safety reached his office, none of us would have driven over that highway 20 times a month as we do. Now, this is going to be the first big test for Italy's new government. They're blaming the collapse on the company licensed to manage the highway and the bridge. The Deputy Prime Minister, Luigi Di Maio, whose five-star movement is staunchly anti-business, said the company, instead of investing money for maintenance, they divide the profits, and that's why the bridge fails. But the five-star movement is also the target of criticism, since in the past it had opposed plans to replace the bridge. Now several of them are saying the bridge must be torn down and replaced as soon as possible.
Well, the AP is quoting an expert in construction, Antonio Brencic, at the University of Genoa, who had, before the collapse, called the bridge a failure of engineering. And people keep talking about the age of the bridge, but 50 years is not that old. Is it thought that, you know, maybe it shouldn't have been built with concrete? People who witnessed it said it was like seeing powder. You know, it just turned into powder when it fell.
It was basically under constant repairs, according to what people who lived around there and saw. But the company that has the license insists that it has followed all the rules and kept up maintenance as it was supposed to. We'll have to say it's going to take a long time before an exact cause is determined.
Well, meanwhile, I know this was a huge span and an important one, but are people also casting glances at other bridges?
Absolutely. The transport minister has said now that he's ordered a very intense review of Italy's aging infrastructure throughout the country. The fact is, you know, this is a country, you know, it's pretty old. It goes back to the Roman Empire. The Italians pride themselves on repairing and restoring ancient things. And the idea of tearing something down is a little bit not in their mentality. And there's been a lot of cases of things falling apart in this country. And so I think they're going to have to revise their idea. The problem is, you know, there's a financial crisis. There's the problem that the European Union has imposed strict restraints on the budget. And already there are calls, again, by the populist members of the government saying, enough already of the EU's restraints. We have to take care of Italians.
People may also be saying, you know, yes, we want to keep the character of the country that draws so many people here, but it has to be safe. Look, just a horrible scene again. I'm sure there's just shock and grief, but also concern about the impact of this on the economy. This was a major way for goods to come from local ports, a connector for the Italian Riviera, the southeast coast of France. Are there going to be other ways to take up that traffic?
Not immediately. There's already huge backups and detours. Genoa is a very particularly city. It's nestled between the sea and very steep mountains. And this bridge was a key link between the east and western neighborhoods. So its collapse is going to have an immediate impact on the area around it, on the city as a whole, and as you said, the whole region, because it's an important link between southern France and northern Italy.
NPR's Silvia Bajoli in Rome. Silvia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In our ongoing series, what a great summer read we have for you today. You can read it while you pick at a lime Jell-O mold salad with marshmallows and shredded carrots. It's called Jell-O Girls by Allie Rowbottom. Yes, it's about Jell-O and girls.
Do you know what makes a little girl happy? Twinkling Jell-O. There's nothing quite like Jell-O. It's a wonderland of delight.
But Jell-O was anything but a wonderland for the women in Allie Rowbottom's family, who inherited the Jell-O fortune, millions, and what they say was the Jell-O curse. Allie's grandmother, her mother, and Allie all felt forced to be as perfectly molded as that Jell-O dessert. Her uncle bought the patent in 1899 for $450. The family sold it years later for $67 million. She also looks at her family. Members suffered alcoholism, eating disorders. Traces the history of the town of Leroy, New York, where Jell-O was made until it suddenly wasn't. And the history of women in the kitchen. The cover of her book shows an orange Jell-O mold with what looks like a Barbie doll trapped inside. Again, Allie Rowbottom's book is Jell-O Girls, A Family History, and she joins us from the NPR studios in New York with more. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, you begin the book almost at the end. You taking care of your mother as she dies from the cancer that's just tortured her almost her whole life. And as she's dying, the only thing she can eat is Jell-O, which she hated and avoided her whole life. Talk about the irony there.
At the end of my mother's life, she accepted it. But for much of her life, she avoided Jell-O, seeing it as sort of a symbol of patriarchy on a broad scale, but also of her own family's struggle against patriarchal forces and against what they thought of as a Jell-O curse. So at the end of her life, when it turned out that Jell-O was the only thing that she could stomach, it was this sort of grim irony. Unfortunately, it wound up being the last thing she ever ate.
Mm. Talk a little bit about Jell-O, because there's a storyline here. It's kind of the history of food in America and new domestic science technology. You know, you just put in hot water. So simple, even a child can do it, which, of course, infers that women at home doing this are childlike. But talk about how it was sold to them in this idea of domestic science.
Well, Jell-O's marketing really took hold around the onset of the Industrial Revolution. Many American women were losing a lot of their help in the kitchens to factory work that was more lucrative and probably more rewarding in a lot of senses for people who had previously worked in the kitchens of the middle classes. So many American women were finding themselves unsure of how to prepare the recipes that they had grown used to eating. But Jell-O came around and sort of had a double hook in that it was so easy to prepare, but it was also this new scientific food at an age where America was really privileging science and technology. It compelled its audience.
Never mind that it had dyes and more sugar than, you know, and made from what, the hooves of animals?
Now I think it's made more from boiled hides and skins, but at the time it was rendered from hooves and bones.
And women were encouraged to do what with it?
It could be a breakfast, but it was also a salad, but then it could also be a dessert. So it was very versatile, and it really molded itself, if you will, to people's palates.
Well, early on, Jell-O commissioned Norman Rockwell to illustrate cookbooks and advertisements. Interesting, because when your mom is actually committed to an institution, there's a rumor that Rockwell is there as well. And he did, we now know, have a lot of mental health issues. So your mom wasn't the only one who couldn't adhere to this perfect image that Jell-O was presenting to the world. But bring us to the point that your mother came to, that Jell-O makes women silent.
My mother very overtly felt that Jell-O and sort of the larger American culture that it served as an icon for did contribute to what she saw as a patriarchal culture that contributed to silencing and oppressing women.
Well, and talk about your mom and her story, which you clear-eyed tell. She was molested by friends of her brothers when she was a very young girl, lured into having sex with what sounds like a lecherous married cousin, then, as we said, went to the Austin Riggs Mental Hospital at the age of 19. After that, was, you know, you could say promiscuous in her life that she was trying to craft, getting away from the family and its fortune and be an artist in her own right. What was that like to write about?
It was a really moving experience, honestly. I mean, I started this book before she died, but it really wasn't until after she died and I experienced grief and loss that I really understood why she had behaved the way she had for most of her life. For example, on birthdays and Christmases, she would send us presents from her own dead mother. I always found that strange, and now I completely understand it.
Well, her mother died so young.
Yes, and I think all of my mother's behaviors could really be traced back to that initial loss. And like I said, it really wasn't until I lost my own mother that I understood that about her, and I could look at her memoir that she left behind with a whole new perspective.
Because she had wanted to write the book that you ended up writing.
She had. She had tried for much of my life to write a memoir of her girlhood and adulthood and to braid in this idea of the curse of patriarchy and how it connected within her family and how it probably, in her mind, connected in most women's lives.
There's so many characters in here. Jell-O's a character, your mom, of course, your grandma, and also the town, Leroy, New York, where Jell-O was king. And then when Jell-O left the town was decimated. But you trace that fall in Leroy to another storyline in your book. You and your mother were captivated by a news story that we remember of a group of young girls in Leroy who had an inexplicable outbreak of something that nobody could describe. They had tics. They couldn't control their limbs. This also happened in Leroy, the home of Jell-O. What do you conclude about that?
So the girls were initially a mystery and later diagnosed with conversion disorder and mass psychogenic illness, conversion disorder being the conversion of emotional trauma or stress into physical symptoms, and then mass psychogenic illness being sort of tagged on to the end as the mysterious spread of these symptoms through groups with no real reason for it having spread. So that was the resultant conclusion that doctors made through a process of elimination. My mom really felt that these girls were very obviously responding involuntarily to a culture that was particularly strong in Leroy of silencing women. And so as she and I both knew through our own experiences, when one's voice is silent, oftentimes the body finds other ways to speak.
Well, and for you and your mom, you had this mysterious like paralysis of your hands. They would like shape into a claw.
Yeah, that had happened to me before I knew that it had happened to her. And it wasn't until much later when I went back through her memoirs that I saw that.
How do you draw the Jell-O curse to your own storyline, which is you had a serious eating disorder? At one point, you were only eating sugar-free Jell-O.
Yeah, so I think that like the girls in Leroy and like my mother before me, a lot of my struggle traced back to not feeling free to speak once I started to speak and express myself in therapy and to learn that it was safe to do so. My symptoms became less present.
And by the way, one of the things you couldn't speak about was that your father was having an affair with one of your teachers, but told you that what you were seeing with your own eyes wasn't true. Boy, it gets intensely personal. But again, as we said, also takes a step back and looks at the history of Jell-O. And there's another irony here, because when we think Jell-O, we think this guy.
We're here to celebrate a different way to eat Jell-O gelatin. With our bare hands.
It's just so interesting to be reminded that Bill Cosby was the voice of Jell-O for decades and turned out to be someone who also had repressed women.
Yeah, as the face of Jell-O, he, on the surface, projected this equal parts daddish and infantile persona. But as we know now, he was really also the face of a certain kind of tradition of silencing women or working to keep women silent.
Well, he allegedly gave them knockout pills.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What have people said to you about this? Jell-O holds such a place in people's minds. Have they been upset about how you've cast it? Or what are you hearing?
Well, first of all, I've heard a lot of wonderful stories of people's childhood relationships with Jell-O. I've been gifted recipes. I've been gifted old cookbooks. A lot of people don't see this book as portraying Jell-O necessarily negatively. I will say that there are some people maybe connected to Leroy who don't feel great about the book. It's a challenge as a writer to write honestly of a place or a person, but also to, you know, not portray it as any one thing.
And how about you? Do you feel you have broken the Jell-O curse?
I hope so. I do feel that, you know, I have sounded my voice and my mother's. It's a constant challenge, I think, probably with anyone who puts a book out into the world, but for this book in particular, to stand behind my work and to stick to my guns when, you know, there are many who are coming forward, or some who are coming forward, I should say, who are proving the point of the book in some ways and trying to shut me up. So I think it just proves the importance of work by women that challenges the norms that we still live with and norms that would see us stay silent.
Allie Rowbottom's book is Jell-O Girls, A Family History. Allie, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And as I think we just heard, you can resent Jell-O and love it at the same time. So send us your family Jell-O recipe. Poke cake, cucumber relish Jell-O mold.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The Future Doctors of America Cut Class. That's the first line of a story by Orly Nadel Farber, who's a second-year medical student at Stanford University. She wrote about this emerging issue for our partners at STAT, the health and medical publication. Instead of learning in the classroom, medical students are watching recorded lectures at home, and they're using online test prep resources that are not sanctioned by their medical schools as they prep for national licensing exams. Orly, for the average medical student, like you, in fact, on a day like today, you get up and you have a choice of what?
So you have a choice of whether to go to class and learn about pharmacology from a professor, or whether to turn to Sketchy Medical, which is an online video developer that tells stories and illustrates pictures with symbols representing the different drugs that students need to memorize. It's a question of how you want to engage and of how you want to spend your time.
And students are more and more choosing to do the latter, choosing to go online and check out these videos because they prepare the students better for this hugely important step one test. What's so important about that?
The test is really important. It's a critical determinant of what residencies students can get into, so what specialties they can pursue and where they can pursue them. It's an increasingly significant number that's used in your application.
And so the students clearly aren't graded on showing up in class, on attendance, or on participation?
Right. Actually, most medical schools have moved to a pass-fail model, which is probably part of the reason that there's such an increased emphasis on these national examinations, because it's really the only metric that residency programs will have when judging a student's preclinical education.
And what is it about the step one that the professors aren't teaching about? I mean, clearly, if they know the students are placing a priority on passing this test, which they have to go on, why aren't the professors responding to that?
I'm not sure that I would say that professors aren't teaching the material covered on the test. It's just that there's a lot more material that is on the test that might not come up in a classroom setting. In addition, there are also things that students get out of being at a university, at a medical school, where there are researchers who can come in and talk about their research or their specific work. Even though that might not be covered on these national exams, they're still really valuable experiences for students to gain exposure to, you know, new frontiers in science and medicine.
So what are medical schools in general doing to try to address the problem?
Medical schools definitely are starting to recognize that this is a big issue. Some of them, I think, are a bit more accepting and accept that medical students tend to be adults and tend to be adult learners who know how they can best learn this material. Other schools, like Harvard Medical School in particular, in 2015, they made a major change to their curriculum, so they flipped it. They have students listen to lectures at home, which they had already been doing for the most part, and then require them to come in to apply what they learn at home in these case-based sessions. So that's a big model that a lot of schools are adopting. And I know that at Stanford, we have some classes that work on that flipped model. And those have been the classes that I've gotten the most out of personally.
Well, good to talk to you. Orly Nadel-Farber is a STAT reporting intern and a rising second-year medical student at Stanford University. Thanks, Orly.
Thank you, Lisa.
Florida's Governor Rick Scott has declared a state of emergency because of a red tide, that toxic bloom caused by algae from Tampa down to the Everglades. The red tide in the area isn't new, but it's gotten a lot worse with dead fish, eels, and more washing up on shore. The stink has made breathing difficult for residents who live there and scared tourists away from coming. Governor Scott hopes to unseat Democratic U.S. Senator Bill Nelson. He says Nelson's to blame. Senator Nelson says it's Scott who's failed to act. Well, while that finger-pointing continues, there's another beach issue in Florida that's also got a whiff of politics. Starting a few weeks ago, July 1st, homeowners with beachfront property on a section of Florida's panhandle could declare their beach private, off-limits to the public. NPR's Greg Allen reports that's created a standoff between beachfront homeowners and other local residents.
Santa Rosa Beach in Walton County is a quiet place with sugar-white sand, pleasant surf, and signs warning visitors to stay out. Most of the 26 miles of beaches here are privately owned. A law passed by Florida's legislature this year and signed by the governor gives homeowners the right to exclude the public. On a recent Sunday, Daniel Uhlfelder was part of a group enjoying the sun and sand on a private beach in defiance of the law.
The security officer told me to leave, and I said, we're not going to leave. He called the police. The police came. The police took everyone's driver's licenses and asked if we're leaving, and we said, we're not leaving.
This wasn't Uhlfelder's first time testing the new law. He's one of a group of people who are determined to challenge it. Their fight is focused in Santa Rosa Beach at an upscale development called Vizcaya. Large houses overlooking the beach here rent for $10,000 a week. Bill Hackmeyer is president of the Homeowners Association.
There are a lot of public beaches, and there are a bunch of parks around here for the public. But there are some beaches, like Vizcaya, it's a private beach.
Hackmeyer is a conservative, an outspoken property rights advocate, who on this day is wearing an Ayn Rand T-shirt. Because the beach here is privately owned, Hackmeyer says people who don't live in Vizcaya are legally only allowed on an area of wet sand near the water's edge.
People can walk up and down the wet sand, and they can sit on the wet sand. The difference is they can't sit on the dry sand.
When they do, it's considered trespassing. A security guard hired by the Homeowners Association asks them to move. If they don't, he calls the sheriff's department.
No one has went to jail in Walton County for trespassing on the beach, ever.
That's Walton County Sheriff Mike Adkinson. His deputies are frequently called in to enforce the law. But despite demands from Hackmeyer and other homeowners, Adkinson has refused to make any arrests. Like Daniel Uhlfelder and other open beach activists, local county officials don't like the new law. For more than a century, the public enjoyed largely unrestricted access to the beaches in Walton County. County Attorney Sidney Noyes says under a legal concept known as customary use, it doesn't matter who owns the beach.
If we can establish that the public has customarily used the beach, the idea is that the beachfront property owner cannot exclude the public as long as the public's using it for traditional recreational uses.
Over the last decade, big changes have come to this quiet stretch of the Florida Panhandle. The area has caught the eyes of developers and wealthy buyers looking for a beachfront getaway, including former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee and GOP political consultant Karl Rove. More and more private beach signs have sprouted at new developments in Walton County. Some even have erected fences and gates on their beaches. For County Administrator Larry Jones, it's a troubling trend. Preserving public access to beaches, he says, is at the heart of the local economy.
Simply put, the beach is the attraction. You know, it's a multi-million dollar proposition that brings thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs, 3 million tourists a year that spend an awful lot of money here.
To protect its economic interests, the county passed an ordinance asserting the public's right to access private beaches. In response, wealthy homeowners pushed for a bill that was approved by the state legislature, essentially undoing the county law. The county is now writing a new law establishing the public's right to use private beaches, but it's likely to take many months and face legal challenges. In the meantime, activists like Rachel Reichenbach say they'll keep pressuring the state to repeal the law and open the beaches to all.
This is important not only for our access as people to our beaches that we've always had access to, but it's critical for our economy.
For Florida Governor Rick Scott, who signed the bill into law, it's also become a political issue. Scott is running for the U.S. Senate, challenging incumbent Democrat Bill Nelson. Nelson was on Santa Rosa Beach last month. He said the governor should convene a special session of the legislature to fix a law that's now a hot-button issue on the Florida Panhandle. Greg Allen, NPR News, Santa Rosa Beach, Florida.
It can be tough to see a longtime local business close. It's especially tough when it's a shop that's been around for generations, something you just can't replace. Maybe you grew up with one of those stores. People in Arlington, Massachusetts did. For 64 years, it was on the street that runs right through town. It was owned by this man, who was always behind the front counter.
Joe Bailich, owner, Bailich 5 and 10.
Joe Bailich decided to retire this summer. Who could blame him? He ran the shop 6 days a week since he took over from his dad. That was in 1992. His father had bought it in 1972, and neither of them cared much about modernizing the place. So the faded blue pegboard on the wall was the same one the first owner put there in 1954.
Just the way it was when I was young. Just everything's laid back and easy to see. Old fixtures, old floors. You know, just basically how it was in the 50s and 60s and 70s when they were in every town. 5 and 10s were in every town.
You've got one, two, three, four aisles.
Right.
Cards, greeting cards on the far left, yarn, and one of my favorite items on the right, the women's cotton underwear. And is there a market for that underwear?
There is. There is, believe it or not.
We spoke with Joe Bailich a couple of days before he closed the store for good. Lots of well-wishers stopped in.
Hi. Yes, hi. Hello.
Hi, I just wanted to say we've enjoyed you so much over the years,
oh,
and I really
you.
Appreciate it. Remember your dad, when he was here and you were here, it was just such a nice store.
Thank you very much.
And I wish you well in the future.
Appreciate it.
Good
Thank
you.
You.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And then another fan, a man with a cane, leaned in the front door with his son behind him.
Hi, how are you?
How you doing?
Oh. Good.
Good luck.
Come back.
I will. I'll be in this area. I'll come over Fridays and have breakfast once in a while.
There you go.
Good.
All right. See ya.
All right.
As they walked away, the son snapped a photo from outside the front window. A few teenagers walked in and mistakenly thought this was a dollar store and then walked out. Meanwhile, Arlington resident Ann Venter was in the toy aisle loading up a basket with trinkets. She used to come here as a kid. Like many Baelich fans, she still remembered the random items she could only find here.
There was some ski masks, believe it or not, that we were looking for the Patriots game. Went to every sporting goods store, found them here. Exact ones I was looking for.
Maybe it was the perfect ski mask, hairnet, nativity set, yo-yo, or that neatly folded white underwear, elastic or flared. Joe Baelich stocked it. He did make a few concessions for the current century. He sold microfiber computer screen cleaners. He still had some on the shelf. But the item that Baelich could never keep in stock, he remembers it well.
Oh, we used to have rubber chickens, 18-inch rubber chickens hanging right across the top here, sold out of those. Were hits.
Those were hits. How did you know they would be?
I didn't know. I took a chance on a dozen of them. And now I bought them by the six dozens at a time.
Aside from the rubber chicken success, Baelich says what he'll remember most are the customers. He even liked the ones he didn't know very well. He'll miss them. And they'll miss him. He was the kind of merchant who'd tape posters about school fundraisers or local carnivals to the front window. He was a community guy.
The time has come for me to retire. You know, sales have slowed down the last few years, and it's hard for me to keep up. And that's the reason why I don't pass it on to my son or sell the business, because of that reason. My plan was to have my son take over right now, but obviously it didn't work out that way. So he's looking into something like banking or something like that. It's sad and happy at the same time.
Joe Baelich, longtime owner of Baelich 5 and 10 in Arlington, Massachusetts. The store closed this summer after more than six decades in business. My own lasting memory of this place is from a few years ago. I was looking for a quirky gift to bring to a birthday party that had a seafood theme. So I asked Joe Baelich for ideas. He said, "You mean like a lobster claw harmonica?" Exactly.
Tomorrow, editorial writers at 200 newspapers across the country say they will stand up to President Trump. The Boston Globe first put out a call to papers to band together on this one day, whether their editorial boards lean left or right, to respond to President Trump's attacks on the media, like this one last week in Pennsylvania.
They can make anything bad because they are the fake, fake, disgusting news.
Or this one last year.
A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people.
Well, some of the country's biggest and most influential papers are participating, the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, but so is the Arizona Daily Sun, the Bozeman Chronicle, the Orange County Register, smaller papers. Let's bring in NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Robin.
So the president also encourages his supporters to chant CNN sucks at his rallies. But don't we tell kids, you know, walk away from a bully, don't sink to someone else's level? Your thoughts on this idea of a coordinated editorial?
I'm ambivalent, but I think that newspapers get to stand up for the principles they believe in. I think that it's smart that the Globe's the coordinating paper in this encouraged other papers to come up with their own ways of expressing the sentiment of standing up for the idea of the first First Amendment rights of the press, but also the watchdog duty that it performs. So I think there's something valuable in that. At the same time, you know, President Trump has made clear to his supporters of the idea that the press acts in concert in, I don't know, to pick a phrase out of the ether, in collusion against him, that they're all, aside from Fox and a few others, working to undermine him desperately. You know, if you have editorials rolling out all in the same morning on driveways across the country at the same time with basically the same message, you know, he may seize on that as an opportunity to drive home this point to perhaps an increasingly narrowing but increasingly devoted fan base.
Yeah. Well, the Bismarck Tribune in North Dakota is participating. This is red territory. They wrote theirs today about how they cover the Watford City tornado, the high Missouri River levels. They point out that there are 89 small papers in North Dakota who report on it when someone grows the biggest pumpkin. They say when Trump was in Fargo in June, he called reporters horrible, horrendous people. And they say no way you can say that. This editorial isn't an attack on Trump's policies. We agree with some, disagree with others. We think the atmosphere of distrust he's creating toward newspapers and other media needs to end. So do you anticipate that there will be conservative editorial writers raising their voices as well?
I do. I think that it's important to remember also that communities if newspapers are operating right, communities experience newspapers as part of their, you know, the warp and woof of their daily lives and part of their own communities. That is, they grieve when something, you know, a wound is visited upon them. They celebrate when good things happen. They reflect the lives of people they know. And so the idea that the president isn't just attacking the New York Times, the Washington Post, and a few select others at CNN, but may also be, in effect, smearing hundreds of papers, thousands of papers across the country, it's not a terrible idea to drive that point home explicitly. You know, there are questions about whether this will boomerang and be effective, but the idea of the sentiment that's been expressed in a year that in which we've seen violence, visited by somebody who had an issue with the Annapolis Capitol, taking the lives of journalists there, when we've seen such, you know, not only legal challenges but rhetorical challenges from people in some of the highest offices in the country to not just the performance of the press, but the very role that the press plays, you know, that's a moment where one might expect the press to stand up for himself. Whether or not that backfires, I think, is a separate question.
Well, plenty aren't participating. The Washington Post is one that's not. And here's something that the Post editor, Marty Baron, who was, of course, the former editor of the Boston Globe, said last year at a Recode conference when he was asked about the president's war on the media.
The way I view it is that we're not at war with the administration. We're at work, okay? We're doing our jobs. Doing our jobs as the press and what we're expected to do.
You know, the point he makes in this context, it feels like, is, you know, would it be better for journalists to put their noses down, just keep working? There is a whiff. We've talked about this. Mm-hmm. As you watch maybe Don Lemon, who was personally attacked by the president, talk to Chris Cuomo about their personal feelings about being attacked. You know, it's sometimes, even though that was terribly unfair, it starts to feel self-righteous and, you know, as if they are victims. And again, maybe just ignoring the whole thing is a better tack.
Well, think about, you know, in some ways the exemplar of that is Jim Acosta. I think he's won millions of new fans with the way in which he sort of stands up and confronts Sarah Sanders and even the president on this very issue. He's also won millions of detractors who say, you know, he's made himself the story. He's made CNN the story. I think at CNN Central, they're giving him attaboys for doing it. I don't think the press has to ignore attacks on the fundamental nature of the role that it plays in society. Marty Baron, when he says we don't go to war, we go to work, it's worth reporting that some of that work involves some of the most intensive, thoughtful, exposing and searing exposés of the Trump administration and its officials of anybody working right now.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Again, we'll see what the editorial pages look like tomorrow. David, thank you.
You bet.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now.